Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Douglas. She's a Stanford clinical professor who I got to know as Dr. Jen on Instagram. Dr. Jen specializes in perfectionism, and even if you think you're not a perfectionist, you'll be surprised to find out that perfectionism is actually not what you think it is. It is a lot more complex than I'd ever imagined, and she gave me so many concrete ways to improve my life that I have no doubt will help you too. So here it is, my conversation with Dr. Jen. First things first, do I call you Dr. Jen, Dr. Yes. Douglas?
No,
Jen.
Don't call me Dr. Douglas. Absolutely not. Yeah, Jen okay. is fine.
Jen is fine, and Jen is sitting in a living room space at Stanford, near Stanford?
No, this is my home office. I do not go into Stanford regularly.
Okay.
So I'm in Berkeley, California, which is on the other side of the bay.
And how long have you been at Stanford?
Since 2016.
And what brought you there?
I originally went there because I am an eating disorder specialist, sort of by trade. That was the original thing that made me want to become a psychologist. And they have one of course, the best programs in the country. There's a very specific type of intervention that I wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. I traveled there for a postdoctoral fellowship, ended up hating doing the intervention. It's an incredible intervention, but I really didn't enjoy that particular intervention. It was for kids rather than adults, and I was leaning towards adults anyway.
And then eating disorder intervention for kids.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Interesting.
I prefer working with adults, you know, just naturally that works better for me. And then I also knew I wanted to become a mother very quickly after that, which I then luckily did, which was wonderful. And I knew I couldn't do a 9-to-5 helping kids and then go home and do a second shift empathizing with my own children. And
right.
So then I made the full switch to adults.
What do you want people to know about you?
Ooh. Is it strange that I'm not actually that invested in what people know about me? It's more what's important to me is what sort of messages people walk away from this conversation with.
Well, Dr. Jen, on this show, I want to know about you. So
all right,
please,
let's do it.
Preliminary, a few things that you want people to know about you.
So I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm a clinical assistant professor and a mother. I'm also somebody who lives with more than one chronic illness. I'm someone who's battled their own perfectionism and anxiety in my own life, have come through that and feel very grateful to be on the other side. And I'm someone who both vehemently am upset by what social media has done to mental health of sort of the masses, and someone who tries to wield social media for good as much as possible and be sort of the salmon swimming upstream against the current of sort of perfectionism and modeling these ideal lives and sort of the highlight reel of what social media is.
What chronic illnesses are you living with?
Oh, I have fun ones. I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is incredibly painful. I'm incredibly lucky to be well controlled, but I was very disabled, almost failed out of graduate school, actually. That was not fun.
Wow.
And then another illness called PCOS, which made getting pregnant PCOS. With my daughter a bit of a challenge. Yes, yes. All the cool kids have that.
Yeah, all the cool kids have PCOS. I want to parlay. I want to swoop around here for a sec because I cannot wait to get into the ins and outs of perfectionism with you, especially because your Instagram bio reads, "I teach perfectionists to let go and love their lives." By the way, to be perfectly honest, I had an absolute freak out about like 3 hours before and then 10 minutes before our recording because I was
for
like,
this?
I didn't. 100%. I was like, I didn't research enough. I didn't do the hours that I normally put into research. Like this one, I feel like I could have done better. And then my producer was like, Michael, what did you say?
I think I made the point that this is a conversation with a Stanford professor who focuses on helping people deal with perfectionism. And you were freaking out that the questions, which you put a lot of time and thought into, were not perfect.
Thank you for that. So that is basically how I'm showing up here today, to be perfectly transparent.
I love it.
So before we get into perfectionism, can you tell us a bit about how you arrived at this point and why you chose to focus on perfectionism?
So when I was in graduate school and sort of newly practicing as a psychologist, I did not call myself a generalist. I called myself a serial specialist. And so when I became a psychologist, I was going to be a lawyer. And then I took a class on, because it was on a Friday afternoon and started at 1, which meant that I could go out partying on Thursday night. And so that's why I took this class, and it was on eating disorders. I was going to be a lawyer before I took it. I took it. I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. This is this intersection of mental health and sort of feminism and mm-hmm. social justice and all these different things. So I fully drank the Kool-Aid and became a psychologist. And once I entered graduate school, I really started to understand the intersection between eating disorders and trauma, sexual trauma in particular, survivors of sexual trauma. And so I learned how to treat PTSD. And so I sort of became this specialist who had these very, you know, intense niches, which often overlapped, but sometimes would be separate. And I work a lot with LGBTQ populations, you know, folks who have immigration stories that are stressful, or family intergenerational immigration stories that are stressful. And so I had sort of all of these different, very intense interests that I loved. I love to work with these things. And there was this underlying thread, you know, no matter what quote-unquote diagnosis, and the DSM has a lot of bias within it, and we can talk about that another time. But this thread that I saw, no matter what somebody was coming in with, was this undercurrent of needing to be perfect, needing to be hypervigilant, needing to get everything right, needing to perform at such a high level that they could never be criticized and there would never be anything wrong, and then quote-unquote everything would be okay. And so when I started to speak about perfectionism, you know, more generally, and when I thought about, you know, how can I bring a lot of education to a lot of people and through Instagram to a lot of people who will never have the privilege or access or ability or freedom to step into a therapist's office? How do I get education out into the world? And it's this, you know, underlying crux of so many difficulties, whether it's, you know, eating disorders, trauma, OCPD, you know, sometimes OCD as well, anxiety. And so to have that thread that can speak to so many people, and many people who would never find themselves comfortable enough to walk into a therapist's office with that level of vulnerability that requires.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose to focus on perfectionism, though, specifically? Like, what was it about perfectionism that was so intriguing to you?
It's not a universal experience, obviously, because not everybody is a perfectionist. But I think that it is, again, sort of this foot in the door to looking at our mental health in a way that can truly be improved upon. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen so many people transform their lives because it's something that, you know, over time, as I was talking to somebody this week who I work with, and she was asking me, you know, do you think this can get better? Do you think this is ever going to change? And I said, of course it's going to change. And, you know, she looked at me with complete disbelief. And I said, you know, it's not that we can't lobotomize you. We can't remove these fundamental things that happened to you that have caused this pattern of beliefs and patterns of behaviors. However, we can sort of add and create new neural pathways. And you're going to start, even if you have an automatic thought of perfectionism, like I still get thoughts that come up, you know, once in a while. And when they do now, I smile at them, I laugh at them, I recognize, oh, this is an old pattern that's trying to protect me. Isn't that, it's kind of sweet in a way, and no, I'm not going to take it seriously because that's absolutely ridiculous. But there's such a gain of time and freedom and relaxation that it's one of the most beautiful things to see change. And that's why I will never get tired of it. I will never get tired of working with folks who struggle with perfectionism. I'll never get tired of talking about it. It's just this very hopeful, very dynamic, very beautiful process when people start to dismantle their perfectionism.
Can you give us an example of one of those thoughts that would come up and that you'd now smile at?
Oh, absolutely. So for me, no session is going to go perfectly. That's absolutely impossible. My sessions are 50 minutes long. I'm not going to say the right thing every single time. And I think if you're a good therapist and a caring therapist, you do think about your people outside of session, and you're thinking about what you can do for them and how there can be even more progress. And so, you know, I'll have thoughts of like, darn, that was such a beautiful opportunity to bring this up. Or, oh, there's this other piece and I totally didn't integrate that into there. And it's interesting because 5-10 years ago, the automatic thought would be, oh, I'm just the worst psychologist. Like how would anybody give me a license if I, you know, forgot these things? And now I recognize it and it's really coexisting with my values. And the reason that I have those thoughts and the reason that I, you know, do want to constantly improve in my work with folks and my work in general is because I care, because I give a damn.
Right.
People call it adaptive and maladaptive perfectionism. And I'm not wild about that terminology, but basically adaptive perfectionism means that you want to do things well. You want to have goals. You want to improve. And that's all fine. I love that. I don't even call that perfectionism. I call that values work. But on the other side, there's maladaptive perfectionism. And that's when we feel like our value as a human drops wildly when we do something imperfectly.
Right.
And that's what we overcome. And that's what's no longer there for me. And that's what I want other people to experience.
I'm still on the fact that therapists think about their patients outside of office hours.
The good ones do.
It's so funny because there really is such a hierarchy and separation between patient and therapist. And I idolize my therapist. I mean, literally would like render her in plastic and put her on my bookshelf if I could. She does send me WhatsApp messages after a particularly intense session or even if she comes across an article she thinks would help me. And it means so much to me to get a text from her randomly that doesn't say, you know, when's our next session or does this time work for you next week? When she sends me a message that, you know, is a follow-up. So I love hearing how therapists work. I find it so interesting. And, you know, there is this hierarchy sometimes.
Oh, I believe that in good therapists, there's not as noticeable a hierarchy, that it's truly two individuals working through humanity together. And we have the immense privilege of being let in and being, you know, participants and observers of humanity in its most beautiful primal sense. And the other thing I want to say is we don't just think about y'all after sessions, but we think about you years later.
Aww.
Yeah, I'm getting a little misty, but we do.
That's so wonderful to hear. It's like so impactful, your work then, you know, if you're still hanging on to this.
I hope so.
Can you define perfectionism?
I could give you the official definition, but I'm going to give you mine instead.
Please.
Perfectionism is more about avoidance. And so when I think about perfectionism and define perfectionism is this intense, almost desperate desire to avoid any kind of wrongdoing or imperfection because that would represent a fall from grace or a fall in self-esteem for the person.
All I hear is procrastination right now.
Yeah, that comes up a lot. Funny you mentioned that.
You know?
People don't think about perfectionists as procrastinators. They think about them as, you know, having the perfectly clean office and apartment and whatnot, but often the house is a mess and the kid's soccer thing didn't get signed up for and it looks rather different.
See, that is my perfectionism. And in my unscholarly opinion, there are two different types of perfectionists. And obviously, you know, feel free to correct me.
No, go for it.
If this is too reductive.
But,
you know, the first person is the person who does the extra credit and turns in a project a week early and won't stop working on it until it's absolutely perfect. And then there's the other type of perfectionist who, as you said, has a messy house and obsesses about the project and obsesses about it so much that they freeze and get stuck and don't start until the 12th hour. And then they only have 6 hours to turn it in. And I identify with the second type, which is somewhat confusing because that method is so far from perfect. That it never even dawned on me that that is a form of perfectionism because the word itself implies perfection. So I'm curious, what are some more telltale signs of perfectionism for someone who is type one or two?
So if we break them down into these ways, so these tendencies are present for both, but they're going to be a little more obvious and salient for the different types you're talking about. So, you know, type one, who's the super high achiever, you know, perfect house, extra credit, all these different things, they're going to be heavy user participants in something called the hedonic treadmill, meaning they have the idea. Yeah, you're nodding yes and smiling.
Explain it to anyone who doesn't know.
Of course, of course. For people who don't nerd out on this stuff all the time. So the hedonic treadmill is essentially we have an idea or a goal of something that's going to make us happy. Oh, I want to be in a relationship. Oh, I want that promotion. Oh, I want to buy a house. I want to have a kid. I want to get a dog, whatever. Then we hit that and we don't actually experience, you know, the relief or the dopamine hit or the joy or the elation that we're planning. Instead, we have a combination of usually imposter syndrome of, oh my gosh, you know, I don't deserve this, or they're going to find out that I'm not, you know, the right person for this role. And then we move the yardstick without even consciously doing it. We say, oh, well, yeah, I got the job, but I need to get this report in 6 weeks. Right. And it has to be perfect. Or, you know, I got in this relationship, but until, you know, I meet the guy's parents, like, does it really count? And are we even going to make it that far? And sort of, it just kills joy. It's brutal.
Sound familiar?
It's my favorite thing to dismantle because people will vehemently argue, no, but it's this thing. This next thing is the one. And then I'm going to relax. And then I'm going to enjoy my life.
And then.
My mentor, I talk about this. She has this exercise from acceptance and commitment therapy, which is my favorite type of therapy to both give and get. And it is...
What is it called?
Acceptance and commitment therapy. It's called ACT.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's amazing. It's the greatest. It's a third wave of therapy after, you know, CBT and all of this. And there are trainings all over the world. It's wonderful.
Can you give us a quick definition of that for those who are just foaming at the mouth?
Yeah, sure. So the reason it's acceptance and commitment is that we have to accept that there is going to be pain. There are going to be things that we can't control. There's basically going to be entropy in the universe. And how do we live our lives beautifully and deeply anyway?
Mm.
Which is the antithesis of perfectionism. Perfectionism tells us, right, if I just think about it long enough, if I just work hard enough, if I just, you know, stay up 2 more hours at night and wake up at 5, then I'll figure it all out. And ACT is the antithesis of that. And so one of the exercises, and this is going to sound extreme, but one of the exercises that we do in ACT is we talk about killing the dream. Stick with me. I know this sounds wild. When we talk about killing the dream is usually this idea that we have in our mind. For me, a big one before we bought a house in the Bay Area, which is this horrific experience, that was really important to me. And so her and I were talking about, you know, killing the dream. And she was talking about, well, what if you don't? What if you never get that? Say you never, ever, ever, ever get that house. You can't do it for whatever reason. What does that house represent to you? And what do you want out of that house? And how do you create it in your life anyway? And it was this beautiful thing where I was like, oh, I don't actually care about that. What I care is that I want my daughter to have a really solid sense of community.
Mm.
I don't want her moving all over the place and switching schools. You know, I want her to have friends from, you know, kindergarten until she graduates high school. Like, that's what matters to me. I want her to see herself in the diversity of the community around us, you know, all those things. And then, like, my shoulders just dropped and I felt this immense freedom because I was like, oh, I can do that.
Mm.
That's unnecessary. And it wasn't that, right, you know, then I didn't do the thing. I still did the thing and obtained the goal, but the goal then didn't become kind of this crux that all of my life's value and work laid upon. It was a nice to have, right, thing, but you can still be happy because our goals are usually a representation of these feelings that we want to have.
Right.
And that's how you kill the hedonic treadmill.
It's so interesting. I also read a study about one of the many studies relating to the hedonic treadmill that,
yes,
they put people in MRI machines when there was immediate gratification, right? Most of it was gift giving, you know, or they bought something. They bought that dream coat. They bought the car. They bought whatever it was. And it would spike really high and go down almost as quick. And then what they found was when it was an experience instead of a thing, the hedonic treadmill went up not even a fifth as sharp, but it stayed high,
yes,
for like significantly longer, which I found so interesting as well.
One thing that's really fascinating about sort of, you know, dopamine and reward and all these things is that if we are, say, planning something like a trip, you can get as much joy out of planning it and looking forward to it as you do on the actual trip.
So interesting.
Everybody hates the idea of lotto tickets because, like, statistically, you will not win. Mm-hmm. However, there's these very interesting studies where people actually experience a lot of joy when they buy a lottery ticket, in between when they buy a lottery ticket and when the actual numbers get pulled, because they allow themselves to dream.
So interesting.
About everything they would do. And this is why, to pull it back to perfectionism, this is why it's so rewarding to help people break out of it, because perfectionism keeps you in this very tight lane of, like, what your life, quote unquote, should be.
Right.
And how you live it. And then when we start to think of things more from a values perspective and not, you know, hedonic treadmill, let me check the boxes that I'm supposed to do, then you start to have this really more sustainable, creative, individualized joy.
And I'd love to talk about the origins of perfectionism, because studies have shown that it all begins or originates from the household, right? Someone's upbringing. But I was reflecting a lot on this topic in anticipation of our conversation. And I personally feel my perfectionism was exacerbated by my school with standardized tests and grades.
Yes.
Because, you know, because from age 12 or earlier, you're ascribed a numerical value, which is at that point in your life when all you have is your school. That is your primary indication of your worth, right? Yes. During your most formative years. I mean, my parents didn't care if I scored a soccer goal. They cared what I got on my physics test or what my SATs. So with this kind of value system, I also saw myself as a number or a letter. That's my rant, but I'm curious what your research has shown or what your opinion is as to the origin of perfectionism.
Yes. So we do know that, you know, the lion's share does come from family culture in particular. There's something that, you know, folks measure called familial perfectionism. But when I talk about it, I kind of put the research aside because I want people to understand it in terms of their world, not just in terms of, you know, Z-scores and all these boring statistical things. Mm-hmm. So one thing that comes up is some people will tell me, oh, well, you know, nobody ever told me to be perfect. No, my parents never said that, you know, you need to get A's. And for some people, there is a very explicit definition that, you know, this is what is expected of you in this household and you need to hit this bar. For others, it is not explicitly said out loud because the assumption that they are going to perform beautifully in whatever metric is most valuable to that household. So for some, usually it's academics, sometimes it's sports, sometimes it's arts, but there's an unspoken understanding. And so many people, you know, come into my office and I say, well, how do you react if you do something imperfectly? What happened when you got a B in school? Or what happened if you, you know, didn't get something in on time? And they've literally never experienced it because that would be unacceptable.
You mean they never got a B?
No, of course not.
What?
No. And then it becomes this very scary black hole because their brain has never had the experience of, oh, this didn't go perfectly and it turned out fine.
Right.
And that's what they usually have to learn in adulthood because whether or not it happens kind of formative years, you know, 0 through 12, et cetera, some people develop perfectionism when they have a hypercritical boss or a hypercritical partner or they live through trauma. There's a symptom called hypervigilance where you're sort of constantly looking and scanning for safety. Safety is often sort of parlayed into performance, you know, whether it's academics or professional, that's where a lot of people seek out safety. So you sort of see this relationship where folks will overcommit in that way, and then their brain never gets to learn, oh, I did turn this thing in later, I did get a B, or I did, you know, end up late to my friend's birthday party, and everything was fine. And their brain needs to learn that they can survive that imperfection.
It's so interesting. There's so many points that you're bringing up. There's one that is a bit more simplistic, in my opinion, which is you show up late for a friend's birthday and everything's fine, or activities whose ramifications don't affect you as much as a grade would, for instance, like getting a B, which is kind of, it's average, right? Is that average or C's average? What is, you're at Stanford, is a B average?
Depends on your family.
But for instance, right? I mean, you're at Stanford, right?
Yes.
So you are not an average academic. You are a superior academic.
I would never use that word, but I understand what you're saying.
But you are. I guarantee you did not get B's to get into Stanford, or your research was not B-level research to have a position at Stanford University. So I think that's also the issue, right? Is like our definition of good enough has just strewn so far from where it was. And I also think of the American dream as well, right?
Yes.
And I think of like why America is a perfectionist breeding ground. Because the definition of the American dream has shifted over time, right? And I just want to like use your idea of the B here. Because originally it was a dream of equality, justice, democracy. Yes. And then it was the nuclear family. You know, if you had a television and like Campbell's soup for dinner, like shit was good, right?
Poppin',
Poppin'. And then the American dream in its fifth, sixth, seventh iteration now, and it's going to an Ivy League school and making at least a mill a year and being a C-suite exec. So the problem is that if you don't do this, you're not living the achievable dream that is on offer, but the price we pay to achieve it always gets higher. So for instance, I probably could have gotten into Harvard, which had a 30% acceptance rate in the 1960s and 70s with a B. Now Harvard is a 3.6 acceptance rate per year.
Yeah.
So I cannot get in with maybe even one B on my transcript. Mm-hmm. So what do we do about this trend? How do we stop it?
Yeah.
Who do we blame? Because I blame the person in my office that answers emails at 1 a.m. in the morning. That makes me feel that I think it's a different level of performance that we have to adhere to. So when you say the B thing, I'm almost triggered by it because a B is not acceptable anymore to get to this standard that we feel that we have to be at.
Yes.
It was a long rant.
No, you're allowed to rant. Ranting is good. So I'll give you some examples of where it came from. And then if it would be helpful, I will show you my version of showing up as a B in my life that's currently taking place, if that would be helpful.
Please.
So you can blame a lot of things. You can blame aggressive amounts of capitalism. You can blame technology. You know, I think back to our parents' generation when they couldn't answer email. There was no email. They had no computers at home. Like it's, I feel so awful because new grads wake up and check their work email before they get out of bed and what that does to their neurobiology and what that does to their cortisol levels throughout the day. Like that is just something that previous generations did not have to deal with. Mm. And so you're right that the person who's answering emails at 1 a.m. is making it worse, is sort of upping that bar of perfectionism and constant work. And, you know, there's no life-work balance. That is the culture we live in. So here's the difference. And this is, you know, coming from someone who has worked with I don't know how many people who have met all of those criteria of, you know, making seven plus figures a year and, you know, starting companies and all these kind of things, but they then don't feel satisfied. It's just an extreme version of the hedonic treadmill. It's the same thing. They go to the IVs, they start the companies, all those things. So if we think about how our brains are designed to live in the world, we're designed to be in hunter-gatherer small village societies. We're designed to live in groups of roughly 50 people. And so our brains are designed to compare and to learn from others. So if I go out gathering berries and Karen gathers really good berries from this bush, I'm supposed to look like, oh, she knows where the good berries are. I'm going to ask her where the good berries are, and then I'm going to go do it. That's all great. That's very appropriate and helped us survive back in hunter-gatherer days. These days, you take the same neurobiology because brains evolve very slowly over time. And you open up Instagram in the morning and you see that our Kardashian got $150,000 worth of roses that day for no apparent reason. And suddenly your brain takes that as sort of this yardstick of, oh, this is what life should look like. This is what I should be doing. That's the equivalent of the bush with berries over here. And so the American dream has partially shifted because we have expanded out what we're comparing to for what most people, you know, 99.9% of people is not realistic. And if we look even back into the 1950s and 60s, you know, there's data on life satisfaction and you weren't seeing people sort of outside of your socioeconomic bracket that much. You know, you would go to school with the same, you know, sorts of people. You would go to church with the same sorts of people, et cetera. And so you didn't have this intense version of comparison that we do now. Again, it's kind of like the 24-hour news cycle. We used to have, you know, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous for 30 minutes a week, you know, on Thursday nights. But now somebody can spend 7 hours on TikTok looking at celebrities, you know, $500,000 shoe collection. It'll drive them nuts. So you're absolutely right that the bar keeps rising and then people's ability to feel inadequate grows and grows and grows. And shielding ourselves, shielding our loved ones from that is a huge priority because it's very easy to get caught on the treadmill of never enough.
I find our original biological imperatives so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I remind myself of this multiple times a day, by the way. I'm supposed to be in a cave eating berries with Karen.
Yep, and exactly. That's all we're supposed to be doing.
Instead, I know 400 Karens.
Yes.
And I'm talking to all of them but never seeing them. Like, how is my brain even comprehending any of this
shit? It's not good. So wait, so you were asking,
what can we do individually?
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm getting back to it. So it's okay if the American dream is, you know, Ivy League institution, make $1 million a year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's all fine. The question is if that's your dream.
Right.
So I'm currently a clinical assistant professor. There are two ranks above me. There's clinical associate and then there's full professor. I will never get those. I could get them if I don't do research anymore, if I wanted to publish on some of the things that I'm doing, if I wanted to go present at meetings, if I wanted to give talks. I give talks all the time to the public, but that doesn't count because it's not in the academic space. If I wanted to engage more in the academic space, then I could absolutely get promoted. I have no interest in doing that. That is what you're supposed to do. That is the equivalent of getting A's. That is the trajectory. They actually are a little confused on what to do with me because I'm not on that trajectory and it's very disorienting. But for me, what matters is that I have enough energy to really enjoy my kid. I have enough energy to really enjoy my husband and make sure that my first marriage is my last marriage. I am going to go swim after this. And that's important to me. And I want to get through, you know, my late 30s and then my 40s and then my 50s enjoying it rather than climbing that ladder. And so I won't ever get those titles. I won't get those ranks. I have chosen, you know, I've been approached a couple times to write a book. I'm not going to write a book in the next couple of years. That's just not what I'm going to do. And if I was looking at that ladder and that yardstick of how to be the best, I would have a very different life right now.
For anyone who can't relate to anything you're saying in terms of if they were a Stanford clinical professor right now.
Yeah.
Or assistant clinical professor.
I'm a lowly assistant. Yes.
A lowly clinical assistant Stanford professor.
Yes.
They would be working their way up for the professor title. And so for anyone who cannot fathom why you would not take advantage of a position that allows you such, you know, monumental upward mobility and why you would decide to instead stay stagnant, so to speak.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes. No, this is the B. This is the B.
This is the B. You're the B. You're the Stanford B.
Yes.
What would you tell them? How did you arrive at this place?
First of all, it's okay if somebody wants to be a full professor. I have friends gunning for it. I have friends who've accomplished it. I'm so proud of them. It is wonderful for them. And so it's okay if a listener is saying, no, I would go for it. And I'd be up till 1 a.m. writing grants and I would be doing this thing. That's fantastic as long as that's what you want. Mm. And the question I want to have everybody pose to themselves is when you're 80 years old and you can't move around much and your kids are grown and you see them 5 days a year if you're lucky and, you know, your husband can't quite see you, you know, across the room, are you going to be happy with how you spent your time on this earth?
Yeah.
And that might be getting the accolades or making $1 million years or doing all that. But what I see in perfectionists over and over again is that there's an idea of, well, if I get that accolade, if I make this amount of money, if I have this accomplishment, then I will feel good about myself and then I'll feel good about how I'm spending my life. If one can't find the life worth living now, it is very unlikely that at that next level or next echelon, all of those problems will be solved and you'll be able to enjoy your life because you accomplished that thing.
To delve a little deeper into perfectionism, I read this study and I want your opinion on it because it has to do with the idea that if we can't be the best at something, then it's not worth doing at all. Ugh. And that enjoyment holds little value. And this study blew my mind. So they asked athletes, if elite athletes, if they'd be willing to take a drug that guaranteed them one gold medal but would kill them in 5 years.
Oh my God.
Right.
Oh my God.
So they win the gold, but 5 years later, they drop dead.
They die. Okay.
The first time they did the study, 50% of athletes said yes. They would take the drug. And they were so astonished with the findings of this study that they repeated the survey 5 times over the next 10 years, and they got the same results. So that's literally trading a medal for your life. And I was curious if you find this kind of extreme perfectionism in your research.
What's interesting about that study that surprises me is that if they took a drug and won, it wouldn't be because they worked hard and won, which would be the truly satisfying thing. That's what's surprising about that study to me.
But think of athletes that do dope up, right? They're not winning on their own volition. It's the drugs. So it's kind of the same thing, right?
That's fascinating to me because we do know that when athletes, for instance, get injured, you know, high performance athletes, when they get injured or when they retire, there's an immense identity crisis that happens. And so many athletes have trouble predicting their future. They have trouble imagining their lives outside of their sport. And so it's not wholly surprising that they would give everything up to be the best at their sport. I guess it's just heartbreaking to me to hear.
I really couldn't comprehend it. And I originally was thinking, you know, maybe it's because I'm so far from, you know, the mindset of a professional athlete. Like I would get up at 6 a.m. to do nothing besides like take a very important flight, you know?
To somewhere you wanted to go.
Yeah. I'm just very opposite. But I was completely flabbergasted by that too, especially because it cost them their life.
Well, and we see it in anorexia. If you think of anorexia as a body form of perfectionism, that it has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness that we know of. So you see it. You see it threaten people's lives and take people's lives. And so it's the same sort of level of severity.
It seems like perfectionism seems like a symptom of so many mental, I don't use the word mental illnesses, but I use the word mental struggles. Yes. It does seem like a symptom of so many mental struggles. And I actually have severe OCD. I've spent 3 months in 2019 in a psychiatric hospital dealing with my OCD. And one of the biggest symptoms that I was grappling with was my perfectionism.
Yeah.
If I didn't read a paragraph perfectly, I'd have to reread it 20 times until it was perfect and every word I digested and read. I mean, perfectionism actually like seriously destroyed my life, but it seems to be a symptom of so many mental struggles. I have a family member that struggled with depression and binge eating. And the moment she had, you know, one piece of candy, then she says, fuck it, I might as well have it all, right? I already destroyed the perfect eating schedule of my day. I might as well just eat the whole bag. And then once that bag was done, then it's, let's just eat 7 bags of Oreos, which I also completely identify with because I also was a binge eater. So I'm just curious about that. When you mentioned the correlation between perfectionism and anorexia, it just made me realize how perfectionism seems to be a symptom of almost every one of them.
With almost all of these diagnoses, you have extreme all or nothing thinking. That, you know, if I eat one candy, then I might as well eat it all. And then there's this accompanying emotional experience of shame and guilt. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the, oh, I ate the extra candy, so I have all this shame and guilt. Whether it's I didn't get into this college or I, you know, this relationship didn't work out. There's all this shame and guilt. And when our emotions have certain drives of behaviors and shame and guilt tends to make us isolate. And isolation is one of the biggest risk factors and exacerbators for anxiety, depression, OCD. Eating disorders are very, very well hidden usually. I mean, this is why it's such a beautiful thing, I think, to talk about publicly and to challenge and dismantle, because it's sort of, if you think about many of these diagnoses as sort of houses of cards, and perfectionism isn't sort of its own standalone, but if you look at OCPD, OCD, anorexia, et cetera, you sort of see it within the criteria. And if you can pull that card, then a lot of these other things can fall if we're willing to be out there, be messy, get bees, you know, sort of assess what we want separately from what we're told to want from the American dream. It opens up this world of possibilities. And it's just, I'm smiling because I had this client I worked with for years and she didn't notice that this was happening.
That what was happening?
So she didn't notice the benefits of letting go of the perfectionism. And so we were working on the perfectionism and all of a sudden she comes in one day and she was like, I went on a date. And my jaw hit the floor because this woman hadn't been on a date in 40 years.
Because of her perfectionism?
Amongst other things, like within another diagnosis, but she was crushing it. And I was like, oh my gosh, you went on a date. She's like, yeah, I went on a date. What's the big deal? I'm like, you haven't been on a date in like 40 years. She was like, oh yeah, I wonder why. And I was like, because you're willing to be imperfect. And it was the most beautiful thing.
Therapy's working.
Yeah, it's great. It's great when you only see somebody once a week or once every 2 weeks because they don't see the changes and you're like, mind is blown. You're so happy. But you see these watershed moments. You know, I see it because a lot of my clients are parents and they're parenting differently because they're not coming from this place of fear and everything needing to be perfect. Right. And then they become more empathetic and understanding. Their friendships flourish, their relationships flourish. It's just, it's a very magical thing. 10 out of 10 recommend dealing with it if any listeners struggle with it.
Earlier, we talked about the Karen eating berries and our pre-modern mind. What evolutionary purpose, if any, did perfectionism originally serve?
I'm so glad you asked this because it actually served a beautiful purpose. And a lot of perfectionists get down on themselves that they have this issue that's affecting their functioning, especially like we were talking about the perfectionists who have, you know, the messy house and they're late on deadlines. You know, there's a lot of guilt and shame over that, right? Which is what it usually can manifest as. But back in the day when we lived in physically insecure circumstances, perfectionism was necessary. You would go outside, you know, hunting and gathering, and you would watch to see if there was a lion hanging out in a bush somewhere. Mm. And if you didn't get that perfect, it wasn't going to go well. There's actually a field called evolutionary psychology, and some of the researchers in that field proposed that one of the reasons we have such high rates of anxiety and depression is that the people who survived the hunter-gatherer days were those who were more cautious.
So fascinating. I had so it's a good thing. Idea.
Yes. You want to be careful. The problem is that, like we were talking about earlier, is that that same neurobiology, you move forward a couple hundred thousand years, and we don't need to be that level of cautious. And our fight, flight, freeze response is being activated by an email, not by a mountain. Mm. And so the first thing I say to people, they come in and they want to fix everything right away because they're perfectionists, right? So they're like, tell me what to do. I'll do all the things. It's great. I love my clients. But they'll say, you know, what's the first thing I have to do? And I'm like, well, the first thing you have to do is develop self-compassion and start to tell yourself it makes sense when you have these extreme drives to perfectionism. You know, they've been trying to push it away usually for years. It takes an average of 7 years for somebody to come into therapy after they've developed a difficulty. Yeah, it's very upsetting and why I hang out on Instagram a lot. So they're pushing it away. I'm saying, don't push it away. Acknowledge that this is a part of you and work with it, but you can also take away its power. So I describe myself as a perfectionist in recovery, just like somebody would say they were an alcoholic in recovery, because I need to constantly be willing to put myself out there. I need to be willing to show up imperfectly. I need to remind myself, like I was talking about purposefully not getting promoted because it will create more work. I was in a meeting and one of my colleagues who I adore, she's brilliant, she's fantastic, and she got promoted. And I felt this wave of like jealousy and wait, I should be doing that. Why? She can do it. I can do it too. I can do it. And I was like, Jeff, you've made this decision a million times over. You have to remind yourself that this is a values-based decision. And then I felt fine. And again, going against the guilt and shame and the hiding, I talked to her about it. And I was like, hey, I'm so happy for you. There was a point where I was like, oh, I got to do that too. I know that it's not for me. And she was like, yeah, I know. And we, you know, talked about that decision-making process.
Yeah.
And so it's bringing it out into the light and not having shame about it.
Now that we're not being chased by lions, does it have any positive effects or is it strictly maladaptive?
So everything is adaptive or maladaptive based on the dose. So you can have a dosage of anything, even the most positive behaviors, you know, yoga, super positive behavior. Right. But if somebody's doing yoga 12 hours a day to cope with something and to just not interact with people, maladaptive. Okay. Like I have no problem. I'm in California. People are like, oh, Dr. Douglas, I smoke weed. I'm like, I don't care. I don't care if you do, if you're doing it in the proper dosage. I care if it's affecting your life negatively. So a dose of perfectionism is okay. I was very tired on Tuesday and I had put myself down to volunteer at my kid's school and I woke up and I was like, oh, I don't want to do this. I know that my daughter would have been really disappointed. And so I picked myself up and I did it. And that's because, you know, being a very present and involved parent, that is the utmost, most important thing in my life, period, bar none at this point. And so if I didn't have a touch of, you know, perfectionism and high achievement in that way, it would be hard to show up when I'm not feeling it.
Right.
So it can be helpful, but it's about the dosage. If you're trying to do everything perfectly, you're going to burn out and you're going to become resentful and exhausted and you are not going to love your life.
Is there one very common trait that most perfectionists have?
like if I had one question to ask someone,
yeah,
and that would determine, you know, oh, are they in that bucket or not? It would be, do they have a definition and do they think that they can reach the point of enough?
But wouldn't they say, yeah, when I get that corner office and make $5 million a year?
Yes.
But then the moment they reach it, it's like, okay, cool, now that I'm here, there's actually a bigger office and a bigger corner.
Yes.
With a bigger salary.
Yes, that is true. Usually when folks are talking about those things, they're usually talking about goals and like then they'll be able to relax. Perfectionists don't just think about the next thing. We want to problem solve like 20 years ahead of where we're at. So it's not just about the corner office. The corner office is when they think they're going to relax. But right. What's actually enough is when they have enough money in the bank to retire and also help their kids and also do this. And then they travel the world. Da, 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 da. Like the list doesn't stop.
Okay, got it.
That's sort of the difference.
Interesting.
And is it accomplishable in one human lifespan?
So I want to help our listeners to, in your words, begin to break free from perfectionism.
Yes.
So when I find myself stuck in a perfectionism procrastination loop, what are some good techniques for breaking free of that? I'm dealing with this right now. I just need to say it on the podcast. I'm dealing with this right now because I'm applying to graduate school.
Ah, I'm so excited for you.
Thank you.
Also, I'm so sorry. Simultaneously, grief and excitement.
Thank you.
Can I ask for what?
Of course you can. I'm applying to two different programs. I'm applying to one program, which is a counseling in mental health.
Stop. We're going to talk after.
And then I'm also applying to a program about humanitarian emergencies in developing countries.
That's amazing.
And I haven't, I'm just going to use myself as the example. I've wanted this since January. Ooh. And the application came online on September 5th. And I opened it for the first time 4 days ago. So I've lost, essentially, not to punish myself, I've lost 30 days.
Haven't lost.
Of time that I could have spent working on an application for a school that I desperately want to go to.
Okay.
And believe I can get into. That's the worst part, is I believe I can get into.
I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can.
But it's not even like a, you know, a 3% acceptance rate Harvard long shot. Like it's a 20% acceptance rate to get into the school, into this program. Great. And I haven't started the goddamn application because I'm scared. Like, why? And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Go.
Let's go. Okay. This is going to be so much fun. Okay. Maybe less fun for you. But this is very doable. So this is what we would do. Can't give individual advice, but I'll tell you in general what we would do. And you will love this because this is the crux of OCD treatment, is exposure therapy. Love is probably a strong word for how you feel about exposure therapy.
It saved my life. I love it.
Beautiful. So if there's one thing that's universal in all of my work with all across diagnoses, it's the symptom of avoidance. Emotional avoidance, behavioral avoidance. And that's where most of us turn to cope. And everybody has done what you've done. I have done what you've done. I'm sure there are literally emails in my inbox right now that I haven't dealt with yet because I'm avoiding them for the same reason you are. Mm-hmm. So first step is to have compassion for why you haven't opened the application. Like you give a damn. If it didn't matter, you would have just sent something off and it wouldn't have been a big deal. But this is something that clearly is very important to you. And so honoring that and sort of there's this softness to it where it's not about shame. It's about recognition that this matters and that's why this is so challenging. Mm-hmm. And that's real self-compassion.
But then it's like, why am I getting in my own way? If I loved myself, wouldn't I be like, okay, like you don't have to finish it right now, but like let's at least fill in like the Gillian Welker Sagansky part of like the form,
yeah.
You know, like age, date of birth, but like I didn't. It's like a self-sabotage, you know?
No, it's not. Okay. I'm going to back you up from self-sabotage because I think that puts the blame on the person. Okay. Again, getting back to cave people neurobiology, there's a reason this is happening. This isn't you deciding, oh, I'm going to self-sabotage. I think that's a very blaming term that unfortunately is in our regular vernacular. Mm. But there's a reason that your brain is trying to protect you from this thing. It really matters. It would be an immense disappointment if it doesn't work out. I'm smiling because I didn't get into grad school in the first round. It was devastating.
Now she's at Stanford, guys. So
yeah, like I didn't get in. I almost failed out because I was disabled at the time. Like, hot mess.
We love an undriven minds.
So this is from something called dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, which is my other absolute favorite type of therapy. And when we talk about exposure and breaking things into small steps, like you're saying, why don't I just fill out like my name and age and stuff like that? That's actually too much. That's actually an anxiety flooding process for the brain and body to do that. It's so scary.
Why?
Why? Because it's too much of an engagement. If something is that scary, we have to break it in into such small steps, it seems absolutely ridiculous. There's this woman that I know, and I'll give you an example of how she used this to break things into very small steps so that she overcame her anxiety about getting on a mountain bike. So she had been divorced, gets married again, really loves the guy. Everything's great. He has this serious passion for mountain biking. Bless this woman's heart that she married this man. I could not do it. And so he buys her a mountain bike for like Christmas or something, and she cannot bring herself to ride it. She's terrified. It's gathering dust in the garage. She's like, hey, what are we gonna mountain bike? Like, come on, this is really important to me. And she just can't do it. She absolutely cannot do it. And so she's a DBT therapist, and so she did graded exposure for herself. And so when I say doing small steps, what do you think the smallest step is that she would do to get on a mountain bike and ride a mountain bike?
Look at the mountain bike.
Yes! That's some EXRP. Everyone's like, take a small ride. Yeah, I was like, you've done this before. That's exactly what you did.
This is what happens when you go to a mental hospital. You know all the answers to all the DBT questions.
That is some varsity level grade A. That's good. So yeah, so normally people are like, oh, she rides the bike. I'm like, no, you know better. So she opens the door. She looks at the mountain bike every day for a week. She finally goes over to it after a week. Every day she cleans a little bit of dust off. She touches the thing. Then when she puts it on the bike rack, takes it off, puts it on the bike rack, takes it off. Then she puts it on the bike rack, drives to the trail, comes back, all these different things. So in your case, when we're talking about really, really small exposures, I don't want you saying, oh, just open the thing up and put in your name and your age and, you know, your birthday and all those kind of things. I want you to open your laptop and then close it and then go get a coffee. Then I want you to open your laptop, open up whatever program you need to interact with this thing, if it's Chrome or whatever. Then you did it. Great. You reward yourself. You turn it up. You go away. You do something else. The reason for this is the goal of breaking something into small steps is not making it into bite-sized chunks so that you get a little done at a time. I vehemently hate that strategy. Everybody's like, well, if I do, you know, 2 paragraphs a day for the next 6 days, I'll have this essay done. No one writes like that. No one in the history of time has ever written the exact same amount every day and then gotten something done. I'm sorry. No.
Totally.
What exposure is about is exposing your brain to an anxiety-provoking stimulus and then have it learn that it's going to survive.
Mm.
That's all you're doing. And what happens is that people do this over time, and eventually they hit a point. It might be on, you know, day 15. It might be on day 3. It doesn't matter. But eventually, it's not about, oh, I got this much done today, I'll do this much tomorrow. It's that they've learned that this is safe.
Right.
And then they do the whole damn thing, and it's fine.
You know what's so funny is, you know how I ended up starting it?
How?
I started
it. Good for you!
But I ended up starting it because my mom screamed at me. She's like, what the fuck are you doing with your life? And I was like, okay.
That's awesome. That's spectacular.
It was the total opposite of like any toe dipping procedure.
Loving, yeah.
My mom is clearly a baby boomer and you are clearly a millennial. I think that is literally generational. I will say, if I had your approach, I would have started on September 5th when the application was first posted online. Instead, I got scolded by my 73-year-old mother who asked me what the fuck I was doing with my life. So that is how the fire was lit under the arse.
Sorry.
You kind of alluded to self-compassion in your answer. Is the antidote to perfectionism self-compassion?
It is a combination of self-compassion, but it doesn't stop there. It's a combination of self-compassion and then putting yourself out there more.
Mm.
It's exposure to imperfection. Like, where our brains will never learn that we are okay imperfect if we don't do the thing. It's behavioral. Like, perfectionists tend to be very cerebral. We're very neck up people. We have to practice being embodied. So people can intellectually run in circles all day telling themselves, oh, it's fine. Oh, I care about this. But until they actually participate and have the experience of everything being okay after an imperfect presentation or whatnot, their body and their neurobiology is never going to believe it.
What's a way to step outside of the grind, whether it's, you know, it's a mental grind, it's a physical grind, it's the grind of not being enough. What is a way to take a moment when you're getting the, you know, the anxiety that comes when you're scrolling through Instagram and all of a sudden you realize everyone's living better, more worry-free lives than you are, and everyone has more and they're doing cooler shit and her boyfriend's hotter than mine and, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What's a way to kind of just remove yourself from the spiral?
This is probably an answer that will bug some people because this gets thrown around too much. And I'd like to talk about how it's different than how it's presented. But honestly, mindfulness is the answer to that question.
Like meditation?
Like meditation, but the Americanization of meditation is like hilarious and awful and super toxic, as are most things with America. Not most things, but can happen in America.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
So when people in America hear meditation, they think like, oh, I got to be sitting on a mountaintop in like a Lululemon outfit with like my hair done, like sitting cross-legged, da 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 da. And what mindfulness actually means is to put 100% of your attention into what is happening in the present moment. And so you can have, for instance, Zen, like Zazen meditation, where you're sitting cross-legged, you know, in a temple doing all these things. And that's wonderful. That's a beautiful way of doing it, but it's not for everybody. You can have your mindfulness be surfing. You know, there's mindful eating where you can be eating a slice of cheesecake with all of your attention. You can have mindfulness when you're having sex. Like there's so many different ways of doing it. But when we are in this comparison trap, in social media, stuck in this loop of what do I not have, it is just a dagger to our mental health. And the one other really important thing I will say is that everybody needs to heavily audit their social media, like honestly, like once a month, once every 2 months. And if there's an account that makes you feel like shit, you shouldn't be following it.
Yeah.
Period.
And what single piece of advice or technique has been most advantageous for you or for your patients?
Probably exposure, especially because I work with women and I work with a lot of, you know, folks of color, folks who've immigrated. And so they've gotten so used to shrinking and being small to fit in certain spaces in order to be perfect. So these are the folks who like won't speak up during meetings because they're not sure they can say the perfect thing, but they'll work until 2 a.m. on the presentation. And so when we start to expose them to not working till 2 a.m. to create the presentation and to expose them to saying things in meetings, even if it's not perfect, there is such a fast ROI on it and they gain so much confidence and there's such a more solid feeling of safety in the world. It's just, it's a really beautiful thing.
What drives you?
I have an immense faith that things get better, even for people in really dire circumstances. And so I will show up to work every day and show up to my personal life every day to continue that journey.
That, my friends, was Dr. Jen. You can follow her on Instagram at Dr. Jen Official and me at Gillian Sagansky. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode and every episode. So shoot me a DM. Let me know who you want to hear from next. Any thoughts, questions, concerns, etc. And don't forget to subscribe and rate us so we know you are out there alive and listening. Until next time.